Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com. I, of course, am always as your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
And the indomitable Michael Snydell.
Hello!
Hello, gentlemen. We are here today to do a full review of the new film Manchester by the Sea by writer-director Kenneth Lonergan, who had previously done Margaret, which you may know in both its chopped up theatrical and more room to breathe version, the director's cut, which we talked about previously on this podcast, but not with either of the two gentlemen who are with me today. Before we get into our feature review, let me remind everyone that we can be found on Twitter at Film Stage Show. We can also be found on Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Email us podcast@filmstage.com. And you can find us on iTunes, give us a comment, give us a rating, let us know how we're doing. It is the Yuletide season, and my Christmas wish going out to you fine folks at home is to give us some more comments and reviews on iTunes. I've been good. I think I deserve it. I just had a Cousin Vinny flashback when he says, "I think you should give it to me," like asking for a chance to try the trial, and it comes off like a real mobster threat. I'm from Queens. I should be able to rock that pretty easily, and I'm just so upset that I can't. But anyway, we are here today, like I said, to talk about Manchester by the Sea. We were going to have a smaller review preceding it, but we have decided that that movie, L, actually requires more space to talk about.
God, definitely. Not complicated or controversial at all.
It's a pretty simple movie. I'd put it up right there with Piper, the Sandpiper short from Pixar, both in terms of levity and simplicity. No, so that's gonna wait. We're gonna wait for
you
that.
You saw a very different Piper then.
And I'd like to remind everyone that we are brought to you today by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. You can get a free trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage. Mubi has curators who find the best of foreign and independent cinema and bring it right to your streaming devices. So, check out Mubi. They have some Jackie Chan movies coming on right now, Project A and Project A2, some of his comedic 80s work, which look just dynamite. We also have Baden Baden, the theatrical Mubi release that was brought out to theaters not too long ago. You can check that out now. And they have some Love Diaz films if you have 17 hours you're willing to kill. So check out Mubi. Again, you can get a free trial by going to mubi.com/filmstage. Gentlemen, are we all ready to talk about Manchester by the Sea?
No.
Nope. Didn't think so.
No.
You need to take a minute?
No, I'm fine.
Get some Kleenex.
It's cool if you need to take a minute, man. Like, I'm willing to give that to you. This is a heavy movie. This movie, written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan, stars Casey Affleck as Lee Chandler, a man whose brother, Joe Chandler, played by the actor Kyle Chandler, which I'm sure will not get confusing at all during our conversation, passes away because of a congenital heart defect. Lee then has to go back to their childhood home of Manchester in order to take care of his nephew Patrick, who is in his mid to late teens. I would say mid-teens, really. But Lee has trouble returning to his home for reasons that we will save for our conversation. And he has to make a decision as to whether or not he can proceed as his brother had hoped he would as his nephew's legal guardian. So now, without further delay, here is the trailer for Manchester by the Sea.
If you could take one guy to an island with you and you knew you'd be safe because he was the best man, he was going to keep you happy, if it was between me and your father, who would you take?
My daddy.
I don't think you're wrong about that. Hello, this is Lee.
What happened to my brother? So that's the Lee Chen, look.
I don't understand.
Which part are you having trouble with?
Well, I can't be his guardian.
Well, your brother provided for your nephew's upkeep. I think the idea was that you would relocate.
Relocate to where?
Well, if you look, it was my impression that you'd spent a lot of time here.
All right, that is the trailer for Manchester by the Sea. The newest film from Margaret director Kenneth Lonergan. Writer and director, I should say. I feel like that is an important point to make. Kenneth Lonergan, a playwright who moved into films. I think this is only his third theatrical film. And it is a doozy, so let's talk about it. Michael Snydell, what did you think of Manchester by the Sea?
Well, guys, I just had my first Kenneth Lonergan experience about a month ago where I watched the theatrical or chopped up cut of Margaret about a month ago. And I mean, even I found that extraordinarily messy, but incredibly rewarding in the way that it develops such kind of an emotionally fraught and complex main conflict, and the ways that it develops, especially a mother-daughter relationship that is avoids easy classification of likable characters. If anything, the main character can almost be called a sociopath at times. But
also, as a teenager.
Exactly. So going into this, I saw this. I've seen this twice. First about 4 or 5 weeks ago. And I was a little bit underwhelmed, to be honest, because it does, like Margaret, also deal with the effects of a major tragedy. But this one I found a little bit more simple and by the book in just about every way. So a part of the discussion around this is inevitably going to be Casey Affleck, who right now is getting most of the awards from a number of critical bodies throughout the country and is the front runner for Best Actor at the Oscars. So he's definitely someone we're going to be talking about. And he has a very powerful main performance in the way that he depicts the way grief can just literally break us down and bring us to our lowest level and put us at a place of such numbness where even when we're forced to react to life itself, it seems impossible. And his performance in that is fantastic, but I feel far more conflicted about the rest of this film, especially when Margaret had such well-developed side characters. This one very much, by design, is focused on a single kind of surrogate father-son relationship. But I found a lot of the film unnecessarily myopic and suffocating in the ways that it chooses to handle some of these other characters. So, yeah, I think that there are some great performances in this. I think Lonergan's script is very good. And the direction does some very interesting things with sound design and editing and things like this. But honestly, I'm a little bit down on this film. And the last thing I want to say is I have to be honest and say I've already told my co-hosts, but my enthusiasm is also a little bit tampered down with the recent discussions about Casey Affleck and the sexual assault allegations. And again, I guess we had this conversation a little bit with Birth of a Nation, and this is different because the Casey Affleck did not write or direct this film, which needs to be said, but it is something that is being swept under the rug a little bit because of the quality of the film. And it is something that does make me a little bit uncomfortable and did affect my overall view. So I'm very interested to talk about this with you guys, but I am very conflicted about this film.
All right. Well, let's see what Bill Graham thought. Bill Graham.
Those are allegations, though. I think it does have to be kind of noted and said.
Much as with Nate Parker, there was never any actual conviction.
It was settled outside of court. If people aren't aware, the court documents show that during I'm Not There, which Casey Affleck directed, he made multiple unwanted sexual advances on a producer. And this was granted when that film came out, and it's something that's only, again, being unturned because of the timing and the awards discussion, but it is something that it feels strange when we just kind of finished burying Nate Parker, that this is something that is being less discussed. Yes, you are right. It's allegations, Bill, but the way that it handled is there was a settlement outside of court. Like the way that it was done, it's not like there's not a sense that it, again, I don't know the truth, but when there's a settlement outside of court, that makes me wary.
Sure. And certainly the allegations themselves, and whether you choose to believe them or not, it's still kind of up in the air as far as public opinion and things like that, and that's fine. But the more you read about the allegations, what was potentially said and things like that, it's pretty damning. It's pretty gross. It's pretty sure. It does not reflect kindly on him or Joaquin Phoenix, for that matter, or any of the people on set, for that matter. And it's just one of those things where it's hard to disbelieve it, because what ultimately happened is the women, unfortunately, because of their position in this industry, stayed on set. They didn't immediately run away. They were like, no, like, I have to try and get through this because I still want to work in this industry. And that's, damn, is that shitty to kind of realize, like, that aspect of that story just rings so true in the current climate that we kind of live in and things like that. So I just wanted to mention that, it is at this point, it is allegations, whether it's settled out of court, which basically means more than likely there's an NDA, so they can't talk about it further. And, it is what it is. We may never know the truth, unfortunately, but it's certainly something that at this point, I think part of the reason that Nate Parker, and I'll quickly move on after this, but part of the reason that Nate Parker got buried is partly because, from my understanding, Casey Affleck has not been thrust into the general media. He's had, I think, one kind of noted interview since this film kind of hit big, and that's been kind of it. And he basically said people are going to say what they're going to say, and which isn't a denial, which isn't like, I don't know how to read that. That's just kind of a shrug your shoulders kind of situation. He's not necessarily denying it. He's not necessarily saying it isn't true or is true, whatever he's doing, he's just like kind of playing it cool. Whereas Nate Parker very much was like, A, he was thrust into the media spotlight, and B, he sure. very much was just simply unapologetic about like everything that happened. And that really, I think that more than anything, it wasn't necessarily the allegations. It was more of
the
his
attitude.
Actions after. Yeah. Okay. But let's move on.
No, I think it's important. So I appreciate you responding, Bill.
It certainly is. I certainly have no beef with having that discussion and kind of getting that out there before we talk about the film as a whole. My general thoughts on this film are that I had heard that this was a very funny film. I had heard that this was had kind of a lighthearted touch to it, and certainly it has those things. But this is not a lighthearted movie by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I am surprised to hear you say that, because
why?
Everything that I've heard has been like, there are more lighthearted touches than you would think there would be in this emotionally devastating film.
Yeah, I had heard that it was surprisingly funny, and that was kind of like one of the main things. Look, like, I try not to listen and hear a lot of opinions on these films before I see them, because I want to go in pretty blank slate. Sure. But that was one of the things that I kept hearing. Now, like, if you're talking about Sundance, and if you remember some of the things that were said at Sundance, I don't remember a single fucking thing about Sundance. I didn't even remember that OJ Made in America premiered at Sundance. That's how little I remember about Sundance. And, you know, like, that happened in, what, February? January? So
January, I think.
You know, it's like it's been more than a month. So my half life of like memorizing small little tidbits, things like that, not very good. I went in kind of thinking that maybe this was going to be a little bit lighthearted and kind of, you know, have some humor. And then we meet Casey Affleck's character, and you're just like, whoa, this is not going to happen. Like,
he walks in just like expecting Juno. Yeah,
I don't really know what I was expecting, but it was something a little bit more lighthearted than this. And I think what ultimately this film ends up being is it ends up having kind of touches of humor that really kind of highlight kind of the human. And a lot of the humor revolves around the kid, and much has to be said about that. And the kid's just going to kind of live his life and things like that. But I think the lightheartedness of this film is just completely outbalanced by just the sheer magnitude of just dourness and things like that. And I'm not going to say that this is necessarily a depressing film overall. It has a lighthearted touch, but ultimately I think what it says about kind of misery and how some of us are able to cope with that, it doesn't say anything very uplifting. That's, again, not to say that this isn't a worthwhile watch, that it isn't enjoyable to watch, and that it also doesn't have incredible performances, especially by Casey Affleck, but most especially by Michelle Williams. And there's a lot of raw humanity kind of in this film. And I think what it is this film is so working class that it deals with a lot of the struggles that a lot of the working class kind of deal with. Even if they have grief, even if they have certain issues, it's like, well, like, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. What do you even want me to do? And then there's also the aspect of, you know, grief as a coping mechanism for what actually happens. And, you know, we'll dive deep into kind of the spoiler territory, but certainly the things that has happened in Casey Affleck's life in this film, he's not necessarily running away from it. he's more embracing it full on, and I think he kind of almost revels in the grief that it brings him, simply because that's how broken he is on the inside. And so I think it's a very powerful film in that sense, what it does and what it says about kind of how certain humans just maybe don't want to necessarily get help. And you know, if you have a community that kind of already shuts you down, where do you look for the bright spot? It's tough. This is not a film that's super uplifting. It's a tough watch, but I think sometimes tough watches are super valuable to kind of bring about a conversation and talk about kind of mental health issues and just depression in general. So.
All right. So my personal opinion, I guess I'll address the Casey Affleck thing as well, since that seems to be how we're starting each of our independent things. I tend, in a situation like that, to go by guilt by law, I guess is the way to put it. So, for instance, Roman Polanski is guilty. He's always going to be guilty. And as much as I love Chinatown and Rosemary's Baby, I haven't really sought out any of his new work at all.
Sure.
Woody Allen, I don't think there's ever been any formal judgment against him. But the guy and the things that he says, much like how we were dealing with Nate Parker earlier this year, I mean, someone asked Woody Allen at Cannes how he responded to, you know, something that his son had said. And he said, like, I don't really pay attention to the press or critics. And the person rightly said, like, that's your son. So his icky behavior mixed with his response to questions about it means that I have not sought out any of his new things either. Mm-hmm. And those are two men who are directors. I find that directors more often than actors infuse themselves and their thoughts and ideas and opinions into their work. That's kind of how it was with Nate Parker. When we talked about The Birth of a Nation on this podcast, we made a point to point out exactly the places where we felt that the stories about him and then his response to those stories had affected us. And they almost universally involved themes that were directly tied to the allegations against him. It's easier for me to dissociate what Casey Affleck has done because he hasn't been put out in front, because we haven't heard from him, and because that's not what this movie's about. And his creative hand in this movie has... he's an actor. He's the main actor. He's the lead. But it is minimal in terms of his creative force in the story that he's been telling. So it didn't really touch me in the way that some parts, only some, again, not the entire movie, but some parts of Birth of a Nation were affected by the allegations against Nate Parker. I think the fact, and this is a terrible thing to say, but I think the fact that this is a much better movie than that one also may have something to do with it, just in terms of how much weight to put on it. But mainly because Casey Affleck didn't make this movie. So everything around him, you can dissociate from him. You can section him off and make him just this character. Whereas with Birth of a Nation, he was the producer, he was the writer and the director. And so every choice had to be filtered through, this is by the person who said those things about the things that have been said about him. So it's certainly not out of my mind, but it's not as much at the forefront. And I don't think that there's anything in this movie, certainly nothing that would exonerate him in my mind. It's not like if Nate Parker had made a movie that addressed sexual assault in a thoughtful and meaningful way and had somehow used that to exorcise his demons, because I think we can all agree that Birth of a Nation did not address sexual assault in that way. So there's nothing in here that would exonerate Casey Affleck in the same way as that hypothetical analogy, but there's also nothing here that draws attention to it in the same way. Sitting and watching this movie, I knew, I guess, you know, the log line that I said. I didn't know what the background of Casey Affleck's character would be. And we're not going to say what it is just yet. I think, looking back on it, sitting in the theater, I was very removed from this film. And walking out, I was actually going to be willing and ready to say that this was going to be another Revolutionary Road, a film that had great acting and an intense story and all the components that would usually make a devastating film, but that just didn't touch me in the way mm-hmm. I thought it would. Now, sitting here and trying to talk about it, I'm beginning to be concerned that I may have shut down in the theater as an emotional defensive mechanism.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm starting to wonder if I went into some sort of post-traumatic fugue state in the theater, and if that's why I felt so shitty all weekend.
Have you been thinking about this movie at all?
I've been actively trying not to.
Wow.
Jesus.
I'm looking forward to spoilers. Woo!
Yeah, I'm going to have to talk about some stuff in spoilers. So let me talk in the most broad way. I think that this is an impeccably written, impeccably edited, impeccably shot, well acted, just like true, honest film. It delves into that personal specificity that I like so much. I think there's a few...
Wait, Brian, I'm just curious. Did you like Margaret?
I did. Okay. Like Margaret. I liked Margaret a lot. I only watched the director's cut of Margaret. And so watching this movie, I think at first I felt, oh, that's a nice film about this thing that happens. But the more you think about it and the more you really talk about it, the more there is to it than just the story that's being told. And it's really more of an extension of the story that gets told in flashbacks. And the implementation of the flashbacks in this movie is really spectacular. I don't know what it is about flashbacks. Like, some movies evoke flashbacks in the way that, like, memory comes in a flashback. I'm actually working on a novel, my third novel, that sort of has the same tact, where they sort of come at you like a wind on the ocean that just hits your sails and pushes you in a particular direction, whether or not you want to go there or not. And they can kind of subsume you. So that was really good. I think that the humor in this movie is well deployed, and especially the way that the humor will sometimes loop back and become more tragic later on in the story is interesting. I'm thinking in particular about conversations that have to do with a body in the morgue and the impossibility of burying someone in the ground when it's frozen.
Yeah,
all in all, I think that this movie is very good and has many things in its favor. And aside from a very strange scene with Matthew Broderick in it, I can't think of a single portion of this movie that really feels extraneous or false.
The Kenneth Lonergan scene's pretty weird.
The which one?
The scene with Kenneth Lonergan himself is pretty weird.
Who?
Where he argues with him. He argues with that guy while yelling at Patrick.
Oh, that was Kenneth Lonergan?
Yep. And then the camera like follows him for a little parenting. While. Yeah.
I loved that. I thought that things like that, because like we always see these movies where like two characters are having like an emotional like shouting match, and like people interrupt things all the time with like no clear idea of what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
So, but I also love the fact that like his nephew says like, "Are you fundamentally like broken?"
Yeah.
Because yeah,
he calls him on his shit. He's just like, "What are you doing right now?"
Lucas Hedges in this is fantastic. I think that he steals away most of the scenes that he has with Casey Affleck. Just because he very perfectly captures that kind of sensation of like you're lost, and so you kind of keep trying to move forward in the same way because there's not really a lot of other options.
To be fair, though, he does have the showier role. Like, because Casey Affleck just, I think he says all of, I don't know, 30, 40 words in this entire film.
I don't know.
Mumbles 30 to 40 words.
I mean, he talks a little bit more than that, but like, this is not someone that is really kind of emoting throughout the film. He's very much shut down.
Right.
Especially
he is a broken man. And he does speak often, I feel. I think that saying he only speaks 30 words is a little unfair. But I think that his emotional inability to connect with people and his like crippling lack of knowledge as to what he should be doing in any given moment, it helps to kind of like break that communications barrier in a way that is more effective than if he was just silent.
Sure.
So yeah, I would say like, you know, A+, 10 stars, go out and see it. I'm looking at the IMDb page right now, and the pull quote is a masterpiece. I don't know if I want to deploy the M word. I guess I should. I can't really think of any reason it's not. And I thought that I had emotional distance from this, but as I said, I'm starting to think that maybe I was just like walled off from it, and discussing it is unfortunately going to do that. So stay tuned to the end to see if I call this.
This is a fascinating experience.
Yeah, that's a word for it. So. Yeah, are we any non-spoiler things to say before we should like go in and talk about it? I mean, I think that calling it, you know, all around fucking wonderful that people should go out and see it is I don't really have much else to say. It's the unfortunate thing about a super good movie is that sometimes it's difficult to say things that aren't directly related to the plot.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think I'm lesser than you two potentially, but I guess most of the things I can talk about are mostly related to spoilers. I just don't think the rest of this film is as well developed as the central conflict. I guess that's the best way to start, and I look forward to talking about it. So yes, I would recommend go see it.
Okay.
Bring the family. A perfect Christmas treat.
No, God,
treat.
No.
My mom did not like this.
Oh, jeez. Who would have thought? Did I ever, I'll try to reset myself emotionally with a dumb story. Did I ever tell you guys about when I made my family watch The Lives of Others?
The Lives of Others? What was that?
The German film about the guy who's in the Stasi and like spies on the poet.
Yeah, it's like the audio, yeah, where he's the...
Yeah,
no, I don't think I saw that.
Anyway, the movie ends like four times, and the last one is like vaguely uplifting, but the first three are devastating. And I told my family, like, we should watch this. It has a happy ending, because I had to like convince them, because they called me the Prince of Darkness. And they were thoroughly unimpressed with what I considered a happy ending, especially coming off the heels of three much darker endings. So... this movie, I feel like I wouldn't even be able to say, oh, it has a happy ending. It's not.
No, you probably already burned that bridge anyways.
Yeah, they would never.
They're like, oh, okay, we're avoiding that movie.
I told them to watch a Pixar film, and they're like, really? I like had to really push for Shaun the Sheep. My mother was taking care of
you and Shaun the Sheep.
Yeah, you gotta love Shaun the Sheep. Like, my mother didn't hear my nephew, and I was like, you should take him to see Shaun the Sheep. And she was like, oh, God, what happens in it, Brian? And I was like, no, it's really cute.
It would have been great if you were eating, like, lamb chops while you're discussing, like, going to see Shaun the Sheep, and she's just like, oh, Jesus. Like, right now?
Delicious.
You're recommending?
All right, well, let's get into spoilers for Manchester by the Sea. So, what we know entering this movie is that Kyle Chandler's character, Joe Chandler, has a congenital heart failure. And he's given
within like the first 5 minutes, maybe.
Yeah. And so he goes to the, he is brought to the hospital. Casey Affleck's character, Lee, drives up to see him. And in transit, his brother dies. Luckily for Lee and Patrick, his nephew, Joe has been given enough time to know about the fact that this is a possibility, that he has set like everything up. He owns his house and his boat outright. So you'd really just have to pay taxes on those. Really just the house. And then he has set aside money for the upkeep of Patrick. And he's even set aside moving costs for Lee. Like, everything's great. And you're just like, Lee, why the hell can't you just, like, ditch your shitty life as a janitor in Quincy and come up to this, like, cute little oceanside town and just be there? And then you start seeing the flashbacks. And when we meet Lee, he is living alone in a basement one-bedroom apartment. But in the flashbacks, first we see him with his brother and his nephew, so you know they have a decent relationship, or had at least. And then he goes home. And when he goes home, he enters the house and he says hello to his daughter. And then he goes into his bedroom to see his wife, and he says hello to his second daughter. And then once that second daughter has left the room, he goes to a crib and picks up a baby. And it's like a really perverse magic trick that the movie keeps doing with editing.
Mm-hmm.
As you're just introduced to more and more of these children. And then the question starts to become, where are the children now? And we discover...
Well, also, where is the wife?
Right. And so... Like, for me, like, the wife, it's like, oh, you know, your marriage can fall apart. But, like, you don't... A marriage, no matter how acrimonious it is when it falls apart, usually doesn't lead to the three children just disappearing. And then we see in a flashback that he had a party with some friends. They were all drunk. Apparently were also doing cocaine. And when the party was over, he goes to the package store to pick up some more beer, and comes home to find his house engulfed in flames. His wife is outside screaming, and the children are nowhere to be seen. Then we cut to the next, or I guess not the next morning, but later on that night, but the sun has started to come up, and the firemen start pulling out the body bags of the children. And then we cut to the police station, where he gives his account of the night and talks about how he started a fire because the central air in the house dries out his wife's sinuses. And he started the fire because his children live on the top floor and it was particularly cold up there. And so when he went to the package store, he put more logs on the fire so it would keep burning while he was gone, but he couldn't remember if he put the screen up or not. And so the assumption is that one of the logs rolled out of the fire and got the house on fire. And since his wife lived on the first floor and the children lived on the second, the fire people were able to come and get his wife out, but they weren't able to reach the children because the boiler exploded. This is tragic, and his performance during this scene is equally tragic. I think it's even more tragic when punctuated by what follows, which is that they tell him he can go home.
Yeah.
And you can see in his eyes this realization that, like, nothing is going to happen to him.
Yeah.
And he even says, like, I can just leave, like, you know, there's nothing, like, you guys aren't going to do anything. And they say, like, there's no law against not putting a screen on your fire. Like, you forgot. Yeah. Forensics seems to back this up. It's a tragedy, but you can go. And the sound design and the editing of the scene that follows, where he is standing outside of the interrogation room and you see him from the front and then behind and then the front again as he's looking at his father and his brother who are there to pick him up. And then a cop walks by and he grabs the police officer's gun and tries to shoot himself in the head. But because that cop is apparently very responsible, either the safety is on or there's not a bullet in the chamber or both. And he isn't able to kill himself.
Yeah, it looked like both.
Yeah, he isn't able to kill himself by the time he's wrestled to the ground. And so that's what he's dealing with. That's why he can't just man up and stay in Manchester with his nephew. I think one of the things I like most about this movie is that there is a very clearly delineated split perception. Some people seem to pity him or sympathize with him, and other people think he's a monster.
Well, and I do want to point out that you say that's the only reason, and I say yes, partly it is the surrounding that he just can't get over, but he actually puts forth effort to try and like find a job there. Yeah. And we see in one pointed scene where someone basically says, I don't want him around here. He can't work here. And we later find out part of the reason, more than likely, why he's been kind of ostracized from this community. And that's unfortunately because his wife at the time did not take it kindly that, you know, he basically fucked up and killed their children.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that she blamed him heavily, which I don't think is it's not entirely out of line, but it seems as though it may have further exacerbated things just beyond what would have gone on anyway.
Sure. And more than likely it became a very public thing what happened versus a private thing.
Well,
because
it seems like a small town. Yeah. Like everyone seems to know each other. So
sure.
Yeah.
Like, and there's a big thing.
You know, a family loses three children, that's gonna become a fairly big thing.
And the unfortunate reality for him is he can't, like, I mean, even if he wanted to say, no, it's not really my fault, it still kind of is his fault. There's nothing for him really to say except outright lie and say, no, that's not what happened, which, of course, would just come back on him anyways. So he's put in such a tough position if she did kind of go, you know, telling everybody and grieving very openly, which, you know, look, like that's a human reaction. And I don't necessarily blame her for it, but it certainly damaged his perception in that town to the point where it seems very obvious that there's nothing there for him. He's not going to be able to live there. And it's just a very, very shitty situation to be in, because like I said, like he can't be like, no, it wasn't all my fault, because yes, it kind of was. You made a mistake. It was an honest mistake, but there's a lot of circumstantial things around it that just don't make it look all that much better. And it doesn't support the claim that, you know, it's not really your fault, because it kind of is.
I don't think it was just optics either. I think it's like, well, I think what you're saying is very possible as well. But I honestly didn't think about that as much, of the fact that like he just literally every time he seemed like he was in a familiar place in Manchester. You know, going back to the main scene where he's talking, or excuse me, going back to the scene that precedes the main flashback, you know, where he's just looking out over the frozen lake, and it's just every place in this town just has this totemic just pain. Like there, every single place he goes, like it's not only, I didn't only get the sense that it was that he didn't feel there were opportunities here.
Sure. Sure. And that's what I said.
That's a vessel.
Yeah. And that's what I said. I think it's definitely two parts of that. So he couldn't win in either direction, but again, he does make the effort to go around and kind of shop his name around and basically be like, hey, like, you know, we see him go to at least two businesses. So, you know, he tried. he did seem to make an effort to kind of get over that hump at least twice.
Yeah, he really does, and I think the movie has a lot to say about how, no matter how good your reasons are, there's sometimes like certain things that happen that you just aren't capable of really coming back from, that are going to stick with you and keep tearing at you. And I find it sort of comforting that the movie is willing to say that.
Yeah. Because
I feel like a lot of what we do nowadays is, you know, we always tell people, like, it'll get better. We love stories of enemies who become friends. And we love movies and books and stuff that have a damaged character who either finds new love or discovers the secret keyword to their brain that'll help them to move on from a tragedy. But very few movies that are willing to empathetically, I'll say more than sympathetically, look at a character and understand their all-encompassing, debilitating grief and be able to say, like, this person is broken because of this, but that doesn't mean that they are not responding appropriately.
Sure, yeah.
And that's one of the more powerful messages to come out of this, because, again, in our current present world, that's not something you're allowed oftentimes. You know, you're not allowed to stay unhappy. You're not allowed to be alone with that. And then when you're out, you know, you're not allowed to be upset about it. And it's nice that this movie both reflects that reality while also allowing for the truth of its being and its nature.
Yeah.
And I mean, it says that, but it also says, like, he's making an effort to try and come to terms with the fact that he's got to raise this child. He's been given custody of this child that he didn't really want that responsibility, especially considering why he left the town in the fucking first place, right? It's just like, why, like, you know, his genuine shock when he's at the lawyer's office and is being told that he's given sole custody of a 16-year-old boy is kind of like, the fuck? Like, why is this happening? Like, did my brother think that this was going to make me better? Like, what did he, and, you know, in most narratives that would kind of take on this kind of subject matter, yeah, he would get better. Right. Like that would be kind of the normal, typical kind of, you know, he had a rough life and then he had this responsibility and he just kind of, you know, he manned up and he just kind of got over it. And it's like, yeah. that is 100% not this film, not this story. But he does at one point tell the kid, and I'm forgive me for not knowing the kid's name off the top
Patrick,
of my head.
Patrick.
He tells him, yeah, I could just call him Lucas Hedges because I'm not going to remember Patrick. But he tells him point blank, he's like, I can't beat this.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's both simultaneously a cry for help, but it's also an acceptance of, look, I haven't, maybe I, and we don't know what routes he's kind of gone through to try and get over this, right? Like, we don't see that direct history.
Right, we don't see it, but it's heavily implied that he was committed.
Go ahead.
I said it's heavily implied that he was committed.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, I didn't get that either.
Well, after he tried to kill himself in the police station, then they're talking about him moving to Boston, and there's intimations there. And then when he picks up Patrick from Patrick's mother's house, where she has, you know, thrown out the bottle and found Jesus, he says to Patrick, you know, oh, well, you know, it seems like she's all right. You know, it's not like she's in a psych ward. And Patrick says to him, Jesus, you really don't want to take me, do you? Which to me was, you know, him saying, like, you know, I was in a psych ward. So at least she's not as bad as I was, as like kind of a joke. And Patrick saying, oh, okay, that's what this is about.
I didn't get that at all.
Yeah, I got it from the fact that, like, his mother, like, compared to him, his mother was completely off the fucking rails. Like, at least this guy is holding down a job and, like, keeps his pants on when he's supposed to. this woman was not doing any of those things. Like, she was a fucking wreck. Him, by comparison, I think was tamer. We'll say that. I won't say tame, but tame.
A guy who grabs a cop from a fucking gun to shoot himself in the head, Bill, is
a minute after like the same night. He's still high on cocaine. He's still like coming down from all of this shit. You get that news. Yeah, I can see why in that moment. That's what happened. I don't think I do think, fine, the logistics of it, if you do try to commit suicide in front of a bunch of law enforcement officers, more than likely you are going to get, like, put into kind of psychiatric care, at least for a little bit, because you can't grab a police officer's weapon and attempt to kill yourself. That is kind of against the law, even if they stop you. Like, no matter what you just did, you did something highly, highly illegal in a police station, not necessarily going to fly. And more than likely, that small town wants to kind of rally around you and just say, hey, we want to keep you kind of, you know, we want to help you. And I'm sure they probably tried to get him committed or whatever it may be.
Some of them would say that. Some of them probably wanted him to be locked up.
Yeah, and maybe that's kind of the issue, but I don't think it was concrete. And certainly the evidence that you've brought forth, I don't think supports the idea that he was committed. I think the reality, I think the reality of it, like I just mentioned, kind of supports that more than anything. But I'm like, a lot of movies like this kind of play fast and loose with some of the realities of those kind of situations.
I would stake my life that he was committed at some point, or was it like brought into a psychiatric hospital?
Yeah,
like that. It's not like after that happened, he's like, okay, I'm fine, I'm gonna go, and like he was in something. And I fucking Patrick's reaction to that, to what he said, was not, you know, why are you bringing that up about my mother? It was, you're using that as an excuse to try to get away from taking care of me. In my mind.
I don't think the way that he handles or looks to grief is in any way methodical or in a way that seems representative of someone who's experienced a psych ward. I guess I'm speculating as much as you and the opposite.
I have two friends who went to a psych ward for eating disorders. They're not there to teach you good coping mechanisms.
Okay.
Like, you're not going to come out of it being a mental health professional.
No, of course not. But there is a worldview towards grief that, or not grief, excuse me, towards mental health that comes out from people who are, whether or not they're keeping with those habits. In many cases, it's difficult to for that exact reason. I mean, that's what. That's what a psych ward is partly meant to impart, is some kind of routine or a thing like that. But I don't get a sense that Casey Affleck's character in any way has experienced something like that. I think that's partly
involuntarily. They're just there to make sure that when they release you, you're not a danger to yourself or others. I mean,
sure. I would. All right.
Go ahead.
No, I would agree, but I feel like that's a very large part of his character, is that he would refuse to ever do something to help himself.
That's why I'm involuntarily committed.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not like he went to therapy.
Not relevant.
Yeah, I'm just saying, it's not like he went to therapy. Like, he... I believe was personally committed to a psychological hospital.
Well, then that doesn't defeat the idea that I was kind of bringing up, which is that he hasn't sought professional care.
Oh, absolutely. So
that is him when he's telling him that he can't beat it. He's basically saying, A, I'm giving up in the sense of I'm not going to seek out professional care. Not that I could necessarily afford it. Right. But I think if his brother really thought that he would possibly I'm really curious, really Stickler kind of points. Like, why doesn't the brother just have kind of a little safety fund where it's just like, hey, if you do feel like you could raise my son, maybe this is another opportunity to kind of revisit this idea of psychiatry and like talking to somebody and things like that. And here's a little fund that you can only use for that purpose. Otherwise it goes to my son when he turns 21,
well,
you know, like
it's not that kind of culture.
Sure. And that's kind of the situation in this film is he's both saying I am broken. It's kind of a cry for help, but it's also like, look, I know there are options, but I'm not willing to go through them because I don't think that my grief in this situation is out of any kind of it's not out of anything that's wrong with me necessarily.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, look, I have to deal with this. It's not going to help me. It's not going to make this fast, but it's just one of those situations. And I think that's a raw reality that this film kind of, you know, deals with. And it's tough. I mean, listen to the way we've already kind of had a discussion about this already. And, you know, we're not even halfway through kind of this discussion about the film itself and everything that kind of happens in this movie. You know, we've kind of grinded to a halt just on his kind of mental health. And that speaks volumes.
Oh, it does. And I think one of the things that this movie, you know, to me at least, made clear was the fact that, like you said, he's not going to seek out help because when you seek out help, it's you kind of saying that there's something wrong with the way you're thinking and feeling. And to a man who's just lost his family like that, I think it's pretty clear to him that, like, there's nothing wrong with the way he's feeling, like, that he should be feeling this way. And if he can't be thrown in jail, if he can't kill himself, then the one thing that he still owes to his family is to feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
If the world isn't going to punish him for what he did, then he will allow himself to punish him.
Yeah, and I think, like, for me, going into this film thinking that this was going to be kind of like a lighthearted kind of take on this, immediately was snuffed out when he can't talk to the girl that spills beer on him. And I'm just like, oh, this guy is fundamentally broken at this point. And that's what, like 10, 15 minutes into the film. And you're just like, oh shit, this is what we're in for, you know? I was just like, wow, okay, that's our starting point with this guy.
Yeah, he's not even one of those sad movie protagonists who uses sex as a way to deal with things.
Yeah, no. He's just not going to talk to people. Yeah. He's just going to be like, nope, I don't really want to know your name.
Do you mind? I'm here to get drunk. Like,
yeah. Oof. Oof.
Yeah, it's a heavy movie. And I love the fact that, like, there are moments that should be an emotional catharsis, like his final conversation with Michelle Williams' character,
mm-hmm.
that he just shuts down.
Mm.
And it doesn't come to anything because he can't let it. He's physically incapable of standing in front of her with her new child and even not facing what he did, just like accepting her apology for what she said.
Yeah, he's just flat out rejecting like everything about that situation.
And she's like, you know, you can't even just have lunch with me. And he's like, no, I can't. Like, that's not gonna happen. Michael, any thoughts or anything to add?
I mean, I can't really disagree with this. I mean, discussion. I think a lot of other stuff in this movie is just borderline bad.
I'm curious.
I pretty much anything with women in this movie. Pretty much everything. All right. Let me. I guess make my points. Like, I don't know, guys. Like, I see what you guys are saying with this stuff, and I think it's very. I am finding it difficult to. My brain is very confused that parts of this movie, in the way that it handles drama, feel so precise and so complete, and then other parts of it feel so sloppy and just like half-hearted. And so I guess to start with the women characters. Okay, I'm a little bit baffled that Michelle Williams is getting as much love as she is, partly because I think her character is given almost nothing to do. She gets two great things. The thing I really love is at the funeral when they hug, and that hug just lingers. And you can just feel the years and the history just being shown in that shot. And then the scene where they where Lee and her walk into each other towards the end, which you guys are referring to, where he just said, I can't do this. And that scene is kind of reflective of what I guess bothers me, is that just all of these side characters are reflecting on the main arc, and the main arc just isn't enough for me for a movie. So I guess what I mean specifically there is that
it's not an arc.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. I'm saying arc.
Satisfying, but it's like
It's not satisfying. That's not what I said. I think that all the stuff around that arc is not good and does not feel finished and is incomplete and is poorly written. And I think so. That's Michelle Williams. I think it's Gretchen Mao. I think the one scene where Patrick goes to see her at that dinner, like, that's an okay scene, but I'm just like, I'm baffled that these two main characters are so well written and these other characters are so poorly developed. I have a problem with the two girlfriends, the two girlfriends annoyed me in general, because I guess they're trying to say something specifically about just how involved he is and how cocky and how popular he is. But I was really bothered the fact that those two, Patrick wanting to have sex subplot was like, it just made me very uncomfortable. Like the fact that girlfriend almost becomes a trophy. Like there's a scene towards the end of the movie, which I've talked to multiple people now about, where Patrick's in an almost like a state of like spiritual euphoria after finally having sex with one of these girls. And it's like, it's just like, I'm really bothered. Maybe it's just because I watched Margaret so recently, but Margaret was so good about making all of these small characters feel so developed in a single scene. And I just over and over again felt myself making excuses for this movie. And it's taken me weeks now. And just like, I think more and more about it. And I'm like, no, this isn't good enough. This isn't good enough that these characters aren't developed. Like, I just
find it weird that you think that they're not developed.
I'll say this. So I kind of come in the middle. I think Michelle Williams' character is developed just fine. I think everything about her character is just fine in this film. She doesn't have enough scenes for her kind of role to really kind of turn on itself. We don't get a lot of nuance from her character simply because she isn't on the screen enough. I have a feeling like more than likely she had some scenes on the cutting room floor, maybe before, maybe after. I'm not sure, but
if you think about it, like to that point, like she can't be.
Yeah, this is not her story. This is Casey Affleck's story, and that's unfortunate. Sure. Is that we are seeing pretty much everything from that perspective and that point of view. Right. As far as the female, the two girlfriends, I didn't have an issue with the first girlfriend, the one that stays over all the time, Sylvia, I believe. Holy sure. shit, I remember somebody's name.
Yeah, wow, Bill. You can't remember Patrick, yes. But you remember Sylvia.
Yeah. How does that feel? All right, yeah, I remember one of the women's characters' names. Boom. I didn't have any issues with Sylvia. Sylvia's fine. She's not given much of anything to do except for sleep with him and like kind of bitch at Casey Affleck's character for like setting up the funeral arrangements in front of them, which I was like, sure. I was like, yeah, but also like. What the fuck do you want him to do at that point?
Like fuck off.
it's like you sat down in front of me while I'm having this telephone conversation. I'm sorry you didn't want to hear this conversation at the table that you sat down at. Go away.
Like, I loved that because like I could tell that was what she was going to be like from just that first conversation that he's having with like his two friends. And she's sitting there next to him. And she is so clearly like the ownership girlfriend that you sometimes stumble into in high school.
Yeah, she's very touchy-feely.
Yeah, and so she's like, you know, they're all talking about like his dad and just like what a great fucking guy his dad was. Good old child Kyle Chandler. And
sure, the shark jokes.
Joe Chandler. Yeah, the shark jokes. And then she has to go like he was such like a gentleman, just like his son, and she's like rubbing his back, and I'm like, come on, like just let this be about the dad. Like, stop trying to make this be about you complimenting the son, like your boyfriend.
And they're having fun and having like a discussion about like something else about Star Trek. And she butts in and she's like, "What the fuck does this have to do with like his father died?" And it's like. Are you serious right now? Like, this is a coping mechanism. What do you like? He's about to go sleep with you because of what? Because he really, really wants to? Or do you think that's a coping mechanism? Like, can you not call your own bullshit?
Yeah, no, she is like such a, like, this is a very specific kind of girl that I knew in high school, which is like it's like we're already married and the marriage has already gone sour. Like you were just like already exerting a level of control that is like deeply uncomfortable. And yeah. I love that Casey Affleck Lee like picks up on that. And at some point he's like, no, she can't come over. I don't like her.
Yeah, he does. He has no issue with like trying to get. He didn't have any. Like, he doesn't know the other girl at all. Like, I don't think he even meets her.
No,
but,
not really.
Like, yeah, he doesn't have any issue with, like, trying to steer him away from that other chick.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I
like how he
read it that way.
What was that?
I didn't read that
really?
Way. I read it as like impulsivity on Casey Affleck's character. I didn't get the sense that he read into that he didn't like this girl. He was annoyed.
No.
But I don't think that he read into that he thought one or the other would be better for Patrick at all.
I'll kind of go with that because I think at that moment when I think he's more pissed off at this kid and is just kind of like keep it in your pants for a couple of days. Can you like especially like the day after his father dies like. He has that extremely fucking awkward conversation with him about like, hey, can she stay over? And he's like,
tell you to use a condom?
Yeah. And he's like, I guess. And then the fucking kid goes, if we're making too much noise, let me know. And it's like,
yeah,
what the fuck? Like, you don't need to tell me that.
It's not his dad. It's his, yeah, like, point, yeah, it's just like it's a friend.
It's like your
family friend. You're
kind of
like,
yes, yes, yeah. I understand that. But also, your dad just died. You don't need to ice it on the cake that you're going to go fuck this girl in the next room. Like, I don't, like, this doesn't have to be a conversation that we have to have. And you don't need to tell me if we're making too much noise, let me know. I am going to let you know. Like, I'm a grown ass adult.
I'm not going to sit here and just listen.
Yeah. Like, that's not like, I don't think he, like, I think from that point on, it was kind of like, oh fuck, what am I going to deal with here? Like,
right,
you know,
and
I think that
he begins to act like a father.
Yeah. I think a little bit, but I can see where Michael's kind of coming from, where it's more of just like, dude, keep it in your pants under this house for like he says, he's like, well, can I go over there? And he's like, he just kind of just shrugs his shoulders. And it's just like, yeah, but, okay. So I guess
the second girlfriend then.
The Sylvia is a little bit more developed than I kind of gave her original credit for, but still, like, doesn't get to do a whole lot. The second girlfriend, I kind of like her, and
I did too. I was just frustrated with how the film used her as a prop.
I don't think they really did use her as a prop, though.
Well, I think what Michael is touching on, though, that final scene when he's like extreme, like, yeah, he's in this moment of elation. I think, look, the unfortunate reality is he's very much, he's cheating on two women at the same time, right? There's mm-hmm. Right? So that's no bueno just from the outset. B is he is a horny teenager. C is he's made it very clear to everyone around him that, like, this is his goal, right? I mean, he even says it to Casey Affleck's character. He's like,
sure,
you know, I'm working on it. And it's just like, ew. And then B, go fuck yourself. Like, you already have enough.
Band is named Stentorian. Like, get over
it. Yeah, you fucking asshole.
Kind of terrible. But, like,
I love that every time they practice a song, They begin the song with "We are Stentorians," and they're constantly fucking picking on the drummer.
Yeah, poor drummer.
Just to be aware, it's not moral grounds that I don't care that he's cheating on. Like, yeah, he's a dick. I mean,
okay,
that's
okay,
fine.
Okay. Let me finish up then.
Sorry, go ahead.
So I think, look, the honest truth is, the film, does it have to show that sequence? Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe it doesn't have to happen in that character's timeline at this time. Maybe that's something that doesn't need to happen. But if it ultimately happens in that character, then showing that his kind of glow of, like, satisfaction is, I think, honest to that character. Is it shitty to show? Yeah, kind of. But it's like, if you have a dickhead in a film that ultimately lays the girl that he wants to, is it gross to, like, have that narrative arc kind of unfold in front of us? It's honest. Is it gross? Yes, I think so.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, like, he's not a great guy.
he's
a shitty teenager.
But it feels grosser when those characters get less time, and when that's the weird part, is it's just enough time, especially with that second girlfriend, that I'm like, no, give me more. Then if you're gonna spend this much time,
I don't know, I mean, this film is already breaking my 2-hour rule. Like,
yeah, it's 2 hours and 17 minutes, I think.
Yeah. So
shattering that rule,
like, you know, it's
film.
Yeah, I mean, look, this guy's other film, like, he struggled to turn in, like, a cut of the film that was under 3 hours. So this guy clearly kind of has an issue with, like, having a lot of, like, development and like too much to like fit in inside like a 3-hour nice like, you know, window. So the fact that he turned in a 2-hour 17-minute fucking movie is pretty incredible. But I think it's just enough to where I am satisfied with, like, I like this girl. I don't mind that they're ultimately together because it's not like she is necessarily like rejecting it. It's like, no, every time I go, like, my mom's not going to let me go over to your place, I guess is what's going on. But when you come up to my place and we start fucking around in my room, my mom's just like interrupting all the time. So it's not like, like, to me, I get it, but it's like, she's not necessarily playing hard to get at any point. Like,
no, she's a totally active participant.
Yeah. So it's not like, mm-hmm. like he's like working at it. It's more like, no, he's just got kind of other obstacles that aren't necessarily her in the way. He's got circumstantial shit going on.
She's like giving him shit for not being able to get a condom on fast enough.
Yeah.
Who hasn't been there, gentlemen?
One thing I will say that did a bug me, that is like, I don't give a shit what y'all say from this point on. Y'all can't like justify this. Those two girlfriends should have met at the funeral. Fuck this.
What, you know, what's funny is that I don't know if I didn't, maybe I was in a fugue state during parts of this movie. I think that Cindy knew about Sylvia.
She does kind like she does
say
mention,
something late in the film.
Yeah. She does say something about Sylvia, and he's like, who? And she's like, and she slaps him and she's like, get in here. And you're just like, okay, I mean, I guess that was the blow up moment, but no, there should have been.
No, it's not a blow up. It's that they both, I think both of them know about each other, and both of them are figuring that they're going to win.
Mm. That's
like, did you,
I,
did
look,
this,
look,
was
I don't,
this never
I don't,
something
I don't
that like
play
happened
those games,
to
so.
You guys in high school?
Huh?
What specifically?
Like, you never knew a guy who was dating two girls and both girls knew,
yeah.
And were like,
no, I mean, yes, but like, that's not really how that scene plays.
Oh, I that's what I thought it did.
I think it plays a little bit like that, but I mean, honestly, like I was really looking forward to having just kind of a crisis moment at that funeral, and I honestly don't
Jesus,
understand.
That would be...
Like here's
it's like
here's
an episode of New Girl.
Yeah, but here's the situation. Like, they
don't bring New
Girl
into this.
I love New Girl.
Me too.
Okay, great.
They make a very, very strong point of like, Sylvia definitely knows that like his father passed away, and he's kind of going through the grieving process. Even if she's going to get kind of laid out of the process, like, she still understands that, right? So A, she's going to show up to the funeral. B, the other girl definitely knows that this dude's father passed away. She is going to show up at the funeral. How they don't see each other and have a situation there, just like, I don't know, maybe don't, like,
yeah,
I can't talk it out. Like I've tried to like
I'll,
come
I'll
up
give you the solution. Talk out. They met, they said hey, they hugged like they were friends, and then they moved on.
But controlling Sylvia is not going to let that happen.
I think that controlling
I
Sylvia
did not find it. Sylvia controlling.
I don't
if
think
anything,
she's controlling.
She was.
I think she's territorial, and I think that she believes that being that way in private will help her win in public. This is fucking.
Well, yeah, no, so guys, I guess.
Why are we focused on this so much?
No, because the point is that, like, no, but I think this says a lot about the lack of development, is that
I think this
these
says,
characters are a decent sized part of this movie, and I don't know anything about them besides for the fact that they're dating him.
And in a band. Well, one of them is in a band.
And in
a
band.
Mother's Dollhouse.
I don't know. That was just like my small nitpick with, like, really my biggest issue with this film is the smallest nitpick. Of course it is.
I feel like we don't. we don't. Why do we need to know more about them? Like, what would that inform us about the main narrative? We know enough about them to know that they're not stock stereotypes.
They are stock stereotypes.
I don't agree with that. Yeah, I don't find them to be all that much. No,
they come off to me as certain people with their own complete will.
Yeah, certainly no more than he is a stock character. Like, he's the horny teenager that wants to get laid.
No, but he's like, given an actual character, Bill.
Because it's his fucking movie. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Alright, well, you know what? This movie's not for me, then.
Yeah, I mean, like, maybe you can't give everyone as much time as Lucas Hedges playing Patrick and Casey Affleck playing Leggett. Like, that's just not gonna happen.
I'm just not gonna give it a break when, if you have things that are very strong, I think that other stuff is very weak. It's not just the girlfriends. I think the Michelle Williams stuff is not enough. I think the mom stuff is not enough. I agree with you on the mom stuff.
I think that the mom stuff
I don't think there's enough going on. I really don't.
Michelle Williams, on the other hand, is fucking perfect.
Yeah.
For what has to be done with her character and for the emotional truth of this movie, you couldn't really have her in it more.
No, she couldn't be in half of this film. Like that's just not possible. And I mean, I don't know. There's some development and some things where you can not have someone in a film and still like feel like you kind of really get to know a character. Like, they can have one or two big scenes and just kind of like really feel like that. And I feel like they did a very good job of kind of nailing Michelle Williams' character, as much as this is Casey Affleck's point of view, because everything that we see is basically Casey Affleck's point of view, except for some key sequences kind of after his kids die and things like that, where we don't really see Michelle Williams. And I think that's on purpose. I think it's a point. And we're not supposed to see what happened at that point. We're not supposed to see their divorce. We're not supposed to see them like blow up at each other. We're supposed to see them kind of
to him. Yeah.
Yeah. We're kind of supposed to see them at kind of, I think it's hilarious that they showed her when she's sick, and it's like sure. Okay, so that's the romantic like part of it, and it's like I really like that scene, why he needs to make the fire. True, and so that would kind of come out of the blue if she's not like suffering sinus and infections and shit like that. But so I think it does a good job of, at the very least, setting up Michelle Williams as very real and as a very true character in the amount of time that it allots her. Could it have given her more? Maybe, no, but I think it would have unweighted the film. I do. Because everything is from Casey Affleck's perspective. And so we only see him bump into her at the funeral and during that phone call, and then shortly thereafter, and that's it.
Like, it's like saying you want more Viola Davis in the movie Doubt. Like, she came in,
sure,
she didn't really have a place in the rest of the film, but you could have put her in there more. You could have added scenes that would have it, but the emotional impact of her and what happens with her comes from the lack of any other instances with her.
And I think I'm not
fear of like what is going to happen when they meet, and you get taken aback a little bit by how apologetic she is.
Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm not advocating that there needs to be more scenes with them. I am reacting to the fact that the female characters in general feel very much like a prop to me in this film. And when you guys have, I mean, a good example of just how exacting and precise this film is just the thing you just pointed out about Michelle Williams being sick, and that also being related to the main flashback. And so it's the fact that those things do feel so precise and genuine and on point, and then there's this other stuff on I can't say it's the fringes, like it's a decent part of the movie that just feels very
Well, I feel like we're just gonna have to agree to disagree.
Sure. I agree. I just want to say that I'm not saying that I think all of these characters needed more scenes. That's not what I'm saying. And I recognize this is the story that was being told.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I think definitely this film's humor, I really found some of the sequences like hilarious. Yeah. When the mom comes upstairs, she makes a snide comment about, well, at least we know where they are. And yeah. She kind of laughs about it, and you're just like, yeah, but this is kind of like the parents' worst nightmare, isn't it? Like you not only know where they are, but you know what they're doing, and you're just like, I'm not saying every parent's worst nightmare.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm just saying in general, right? Like, and the film does a good job of kind of setting her up as this woman that's kind of intruding on them, right?
Right.
On purpose.
But also as the kind of woman who would be totally okay with that.
Sure. And it sets that up later, right? During that moment, that clearly is setting her up as like, I don't really give a shit. I'm going to sit down here and talk to you. And when she can't get a fucking word out of him, what does she do? She goes upstairs and she complains to the daughter. And I was just dying at that moment because that is she's like, I can't get help from the only other fucking grown up in here. Please help me. Yeah. I'm dying down here. You've got to rescue me.
Just talk to him about sports.
It's like, can you put the game on? Yeah, I loved how much of the humor was based around like his father being dead. Mm-hmm. When he finds out that like they can't bury him in the winter because it's too cold and they have to put him in a freezer, and then they get in the car after like being lost, and then he says like, you know, where's the horse that came with this car? Like it could breathe on us, and then he says we could keep my fucking dad in this car. Because after someone dies suddenly, like, if you're the certain type of person, like, your jokes become the fact that they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was you revel
in the darkness of it, right?
Yeah, it hit home because, really, really fucking hard for me. Because
ultimately, like, I completely and understand that as a coping mechanism, because ultimately it's like no matter what you say and do at that point, it's not going to bring that person back. So
right,
if you make
either.
A joke but more it's just like I can't improve the situation if I have to laugh about it. Maybe that's a coping mechanism that's like okay, right? And it's like okay, so that's just going to be my way out instead of, you know, kind of giving into the feelings or giving into some of the situation. It's like, no, I'm going to make lighthearted fun at like some of the situation, you know? Yeah. I really enjoyed that bit as well. I love that they like can't find the car either. And
yeah, that was weird, like, but also very true.
Yeah,
a lot of the things in this movie that revolve around someone passing away and the grief that you feel from your part in it and how unfixable that is, and mm-hmm. then the ways that you joke about something that you feel slightly separated from struck me as like really painfully true and something that most movies are like really afraid to delve into. And mm-hmm. so I appreciated this movie like taking the time to understand that and actually put it out there. Huh. And I think that's my like biggest takeaway from it is like it got, you know, if you think that the other characters on the side are a little thin, like I don't know that that's not by design. And I don't know that they need to be any more than they are because they're not playing into that greater theme. And I think just for the truths and the honesty that it has about that, that it is it's well worth your time to seek out, and that it's a pretty staggering achievement in that way.
Yeah, the fact that I've enjoyed talking about this film, as bleak and as dark as it is, because ultimately, like, you know, we really haven't kind of talked about kind of the end itself, but
well, I mean, it's, you know, he can't come back, he won't come back, but yeah, he's willing to get another apartment with a bigger room or a second room so that his nephew can come
Boston. Yeah. And so it's not the ideal situation, and he kind of gives up custody to, who is that? Is that George. His other, is that his brother?
No, it's a family friend.
No, it's a family friend. Yeah.
Family friend. Okay. Yeah. So they're basically going to adopt him. Yeah, that's right. Cause the brother is in Manitonka.
Manitonka.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, he's basically going to give him up for adoption, and he basically tells him, he's like, look, like I can't beat this. So this is, it's either this or you come to Boston with me. So, yeah,
you know, he's trying as hard as he can to give this kid what he wants as much as he can.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because it like, I don't know. I don't understand what the kid's issue is with, like, ultimately living with the family friend. But I think part of it is
he just wants his uncle to stay. I think.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, I think he feels like a connection, even though he's not giving his uncle enough credit, or like a lot of kind of credit throughout the film. I think he definitely feels a connection to him because, like, look, like it's also his blood, and you know, there's a certain pull to that, and it's like, well, like, you're just gonna run away and like leave me with the family friend. That's really weird and not quite what I wanted. And Casey Affleck's like, fuck, like, you're gonna have to deal with that because, yeah, like, what you want isn't gonna happen. So sorry. Yeah. Mm. This movie.
Yeah, it's I don't know if it's just my personal experience or what, but it's like I said, it was easy in the theater, and for some reason, sitting down to talk about it, it got harder. But luckily, it didn't get too hard.
I feel like I should say one thing I really liked that I guess we haven't really talked about. I guess I kind of be close to an ender, but one thing I really like about this as well is it's kind of implicitly also kind of a portrait of how grieving can manifest in very different ways, and how both of them are, and how both ways are totally fine. And can be totally accepted. I mean, it's very interesting how much of this is, you know, spent with, especially, I especially like the way Patrick comes to understand his own grief. I mean, we talked a little bit, about the freezer thing, but the fact that, you know, him just opening the refrigerator to grab a frozen chicken is something that triggers just this emotional crisis.
Yeah.
Especially the way that Lee thinks he is on some level of healing until he hits a wall that staggers him again.
I think one thing that's really interesting about kind of those sequence of events and the way Lee deals with it specifically is when he goes to the coach. And the coach is like, no, you should take like a couple of days off. And Lee is like, yeah, but like I would like Donovan.
That's not Lee. That's Patrick.
Sorry. Anyways, who the fuck is Lee?
Lee is fucking Casey Affleck. Okay. Jesus fucking Christ. Have IMDb open in front of you or something.
But... Yeah, it's
talking about this movie for an hour and a fucking half. Like, come on, man.
Anyways, so Lucas Hedges is like talking to the coach, and at one point he's like, "Look, like I would like to kind of like get back into a rhythm, and this is kind of my way to kind of like cope. And I think what the coach kind of says there is something that we hardly ever see, is him basically saying, no, fuck that. You literally need to take a couple of days off. I don't care if you think that this is a good way to kind of like cope. The ice, I need, you know, and he points it out, and he's like, no, the ice is not a coping mechanism. I need you 100% there if you're going to be on the ice.
Yeah, and he says it's not a distraction.
It's not a distraction. And I think that's not necessarily for Lucas Hedges' benefit, but it's more for the team's benefit more than anything. And that coach is kind of like, look, like, you're going to go through some shit. You need to take a couple of days off. I don't need this distraction as part of my team, because, like, if you're not 100% there and you're, like, you know, a starter or something like that, it's like, that's going to throw off the entire team, and we're going to have, like, a really shitty week of practice. Whereas maybe if you just take a couple of days off, and maybe if you want to talk to me, you know, like he's having a very human moment there, but he's also like, yeah, but like, you're going to kind of fuck everything else up, and I don't need that right now. I need you to kind of get your head right and then come back. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we hardly ever see in any film that kind of A, deals with like a sports kind of situation, but B, like, any kind of boss situation where, you know, the guy's like, nah, I'm just gonna come back, and the boss is like, okay.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying about this movie having a level of insight and like really being able to accept that idea and being able to play into that. Mm-hmm. Because, like, yeah, from my own experience, like, it's like impossible to get people to understand what you're going through, and everyone has what is ironically the movie vision of how things are supposed to go. And, you know, if you're absolved of guilt, I don't know what it is. I don't, maybe people just don't care about like morality or personal agency outside of like a sense of law. But, like, yeah, if you're not found guilty of something, it's hard for people to come to the, like, consensus that you have judged yourself guilty. Mm-hmm. And so any time that you walk around persecuting yourself and bringing yourself the punishment that you feel you need because other people won't give it to you, it's a very lonely and very volatile situation to be in. And I like that this movie gets that and embraces it. It's something that is very much not something that's like allowed in our cultural conversation. When you feel guilt, it's everyone's job on earth, it seems, to try to prove you innocent rather than actually absolve you of your guilt. Like, people think that absolution is the same thing as saying it's not your fault. Whereas sometimes all you really want is to be punished.
Uh-huh.
And it's impossible to find that. And then when you have moved on to a point where you're able to function, people assume that you're better. And like his brother in this movie, his brother just kind of seems to think that he'll be able to come back and live this normal life because it's been enough time. And sometimes you can't ever go back. And even hearing from a person who was directly involved that you're forgiven, or that, you know, it's not your fault, is not enough, and that it'll never be enough. And I keep saying, it's a very rare and I think special film that is willing to do that without. To make that point without making it seem like there's, you know, another day coming. Like, it's not. It's gonna be that way, and it may always be that way, and it just sort of in some way has to be that way for some people. And that's fine, because slowly but surely they may find their way out, but forcing it in a way is only going to lead to more of the same. Uh-huh. Which is something that, like, fucking 9 years ago, I wish I would have had a way to just, like, fucking show that to people. Because I was in a situation where, like, to this day, you can't convince me that I'm not responsible for my best friend killing himself. And after it happened, people were very tolerant of my sadness for maybe 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became a massive inconvenience to them. And so there were people who said, like, you should go to therapy. And I tried that. But when a therapist is repeating back to you everything that you've said, and you have a very obvious source of what that unhappiness is, it seems rather pointless
mm-hmm.
for that to be something that you're doing. It's not helpful. And you get the pamphlets, and you take the little tests, and they manage to find out that, you know, you're not a danger to yourself because you're an excellent liar. And then you kind of live your life in a fugue, and you keep going on. And it's really weird, because people are like, you shouldn't be alone, but then, like, they're very critical about the way that you go about not being alone. And there's nothing lonelier, and there's nothing more frustrating than a world in which you are suffering and no one will accept that. I'm not often one to say, like, everyone needs to validate the way another person feels. Like, if you said something that insults me and I bring it up and then you say, oh, that wasn't my intention, I'll let it slide. Because intention to me is very important coming from other people. But it's incredibly hard to live in a world where everything is telling you that you are not guilty when that's all you feel. And to be denied access to methods of punishment, no matter what they may be. And so this movie was like just a series of that for me. And it's the best... visual audio representation, the best media representation that I've ever had of the way that I felt and have continued to feel since then. Uh-huh. And it was, like I said, it was the type of thing that I just sort of shut down in the middle of the theater because it was really rough to watch him take that cop's gun and feel for a moment that I really wanted him to succeed
mm-hmm.
because I wish that I had done that. And I know that continuing to live after that is just like incredibly crushing. And that's with my like 1 degree of separation, not having actually been directly, you know, log rolling out of a fire that I started responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, it's rough, and it's not an easy movie to sit through if you're someone who's had an experience like that, but it's very powerful in that way, and as someone who's been through something like that, it's so true that it's almost like I can't accept that the parts that felt thin to you, Michael, are that thin, because it's hard to conceive of a movie getting that much right and being that sure of itself and then allowing these other things to slip by in that way.
That's fair.
Yeah. Any final thoughts before we say goodbye for today? What was the laughter for?
That's an odd segue.
Does anyone want to follow that up? You think you could top me?
Brian, thanks for sharing that.
I wasn't sure how many details I wanted to get into, so I left out most of it. And like, it's one of those things where you know, like Casey Affleck when he's like explaining to the police what happened, like, you know, no matter how many details you really give people, like, most often, like, the people who care about you the most are going to do you the most fucking damage because they're going to want to protect you from your own sense of persecution and guilt.
Yeah.
And there's nothing and worse than that.
That's probably part of the reason why he got up and left.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he went to go live alone because it's like, nobody's going to bother me here.
Yeah.
And, like, he's maintaining a semblance of a life because, like, he points out to his boss, he's like, I get up on time, I do the work, I do work that's illegal that we both know is illegal. Yeah. Like, you know, like, he's like, what are you gonna do to fire me? I don't interact well with, like, and I was having that discussion with one of my friends after seeing the film, was what the fuck kind of job could he needed a buffer between people. Like, I guess, like, it's a shitty, like, world, but, like, bar back, I guess, maybe, is, like, a good something. Like, yeah, something where you don't directly have to deal with people, because I'm honestly, like...
Yeah, but I mean, like, what, with his background, like, what else could he be? Like, you know, he can't be a coder, you know? He doesn't have that skill set. I will say that the worst thing... I think that, and this is another thing the movie gets so true, is that the people who, I never had anyone to give me the satisfaction of blaming me, which is something that I'm always going to struggle with. But like him, like the people who want to, I can't even remember what I was going to say now. Like the people who want to help him, you feel like an imposter. Like the people who come up to you at the wake, or the people who call you in the days following, who are obviously hurting themselves, and who tell you how sorry they feel for you, you feel like you're getting away with something. Like you feel like you burned your house down in an insurance scam and all these people are being so nice to you and you're like a leech on their happiness. I remember distinctly sitting down with my friend's family and eating one of the meals with them that had been prepared by a neighbor. Because when someone dies, everyone rushes to give them food with little fucking sticky notes on them that say, just put it in the oven and 450 for 12 minutes and eat it. And just like sitting there in their son's seat and eating this food with them. And I just kept expecting like a lightning bolt to strike me, because that was like just like the most awful thing that you could do. And then like never being able to exercise that feeling, because when you're a victim of a tragedy, even though you did it and it's not you who suffered, really, it's the person who's not there anymore. No one wants to pile on unless they do, in which case it really hurts. Like people can use that as a way to hurt you later on, which is something that has happened. It's just hard. It's like it's such a shitty thing to have to go through. And for this movie to do it, but also make it real and compelling and honest, is just like the greatest gift that art can give you, is that level of truth. And it's just, it's fantastic. So that's, that's my final argument in favor of this movie.
Okay.
Also, the cinematography is great.
I thought the cinematography was pretty fucking great in Moonlight too, so.
I thought the cinematography in this was kind of flat.
What about the music choices? I like the score.
Okay, a little bit overbearing, right, in a way.
So,
I don't love opera in anything. Honestly, I think it's very easy to tip into
what about that? What about that sequence in Mission Impossible?
Mission Impossible? Yeah.
Yeah, come on, man.
Which one?
The fucking one with the opera.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't really like Rogue Nation.
Up? Oh, you didn't like Rogue Nation?
That's no, I loved really Ghost over. Protocol. Rogue Nation I was not really feeling, though.
Oh, man.
Fuck. Well, that was like a subpar De Palma.
No!
Ugh. This is over. We're done. We're done here. I'm just glad that my friend's not alive to hear this. That's the kind of jokes we really loved Daft Punk, and I think that fucking like 2 months after he died, let's just be honest. That 2 months after he fucking killed himself, that shitty Kanye Daft Punk sampling song came out.
Stronger?
Yeah. And so it became the joke amongst all my friends that every time it would come on at a party, we would say, "Man, it is so good that Tony killed himself, because if he heard this, he definitely would have killed himself." And
Jesus.
We made a lot of people very uncomfortable because you're not sure if you can laugh at a joke like that.
Yep.
Yeah, it's awesome. And there's that dark comedy. Anyway, today's episode is brought to you by Mubi. Mubi is the streaming online cinema bringing you the best of independent, art house, and foreign cinema. You can check out some great Lav Diaz films, which I made a joke about Lav Diaz earlier, if you were able to catch it. So you can understand the joke now if you go to mubi.com/filmstage and get your free 30-day trial. And of course, you're not going to want to miss those great, great Jackie Chan films that just came out. Next week, I don't know what we're talking about. So I'm not going to say what we're talking about. Follow us on Twitter at
Film State Good
Show, and we will tweet out what we're going to talk about. And yeah, that's about that. So let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found in the meantime. Bill Graham.
Where can you find me? You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can find me on the Film Stage and also freshfiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, where I'll be complaining about the use of opera in contemporary films.
Like Rogue Nation, you son of a bitch.
I really made some enemies on this podcast. This is fun.
Like Florence Foster Jenkins.
Oh God, Florence Foster Jenkins. Oh, anyways,
the use of opera in that movie was completely uncalled for.
Yes, absolutely. the existence of that movie is completely uncalled for.
They're bringing that back in the theaters.
Anyways, Marguerite's better. Go see Marguerite.
Marguerite.
All right. Anyways.
Anyway,
no, Marguerite is the same story as Florence Foster Jenkins.
Oh, okay.
It's about
gotcha.
The same woman.
I thought you were viciously mispronouncing Margaret.
I did too.
I write things. I'm not sure what, but I do know that I am going to be writing by the
post-modern
time this is up,
poetry, if I remember correctly.
I will have written a little bit about The Good Place. One of my surprise favorite shows of this year.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter live tweeting fucking PTSD flashbacks of my best friend killing himself at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find me on my personal site, dearfilm.net. And I think we're all going to be giving our thoughts and opinions to the end of year lists that are coming to the film stage. Am I right, gentlemen?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so look for those. They'll start coming out towards the end of the month. I can only imagine that we will all harmoniously agree on every choice that is made for those lists. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Tune in next week.